Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for joining us for a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming your way via the internets from San Francisco. This program is supported by listeners, and I want to thank all the people who have stepped up to contribute, help us cover the startup costs for our new podcast adventure. You can help, too. Just go to my website. The improvements are visible now. We're getting there. That's peterbcollins.com. And click on the tab that says, You Can Help. In a moment, we'll be joined by investigative reporter Jason Leopold from the Public Record. They're on the web at pubrecord.org. We're going to talk about the Justice Department under Obama's pick, Eric Holder, and also some possible changes at the White House Counsel Office. And we'll probably get into some other issues as well. And speaking of Eric Holder, our second guest in this podcast is David Ippolito. He is known as That Guitar Man from Central Park. I had never heard of him before, but the other night as I was absorbing my cable news, daily adult minimum requirement, a commercial came on, and frankly, I usually TiVo right through the commercials. But I paused for this one because it was different. It was talking about the need for resolution. And David Ippolito, I don't know how he has funded this, we'll ask him, but he's got these paid commercials running on cable channels calling for an investigation of Bush and Cheney, accountability. And we will talk with him and salute him in a few minutes here on the Peter B. Collins Show. We're also going to talk to Jim Motovalli. He's a senior writer for E! The Environmental Magazine, and their issue dated July-August of this year raises some important questions about nanotechnology. And for example, nanoproducts like sunscreen that you're slapping on your body that have not even been tested in laboratories. It's a little surprising. So that's all ahead here on the Peter B. Collins Show today. Jason Leopold has been a contributor to my program for many years now. He was working for Dow Jones, the Los Angeles Times, was a founding reporter at truthout.org, and over a year ago, he started the Public Record. Their website is pubrecord.org. Jason, how you doing today?
Good, Peter. Great to be with you.
You keep awful busy.
Oh, yeah. God, it's as I said to you many months ago, there's no shortage of news. And certainly, you know, now that we have a Democrat as president, there's no shortage on that end as well, as long as you have the other side, meaning the extremist right, just doing some crazy things and grabbing headlines. So,
well, and
we try to keep busy exposing them at the same time exposing the machinations of the previous administration.
Well, and Jason, I really appreciate the work that you're doing because you're not subject to this insidious left lawn. And that's the term I've coined.
Yeah.
Teflon was what we ascribed to Ronald Reagan because nothing really stuck to him. And I believe that Obama has a refined version of that. I call it left lawn.
Yeah.
Because progressives are quite silent.
Yeah, I like that term that you, or the phrase of your, the word that you just coined. I think that it's true. And certainly in our coverage, you know, we've been, you know, very critical of the Bush administration. But I think that we've been, you know, critical of Obama as well. Certainly, the decisions that his administration has made on issues related to national security, state secrets, I mean, it's just outrageous. And for that matter, you know, there are plenty of Democrats to take to task as well. So I absolutely, you know, do not follow any sort of guidelines that would require me or any of our reporters to, you know, give them a pass simply because they happen to be progressives or Democrats. I think that, you know, in many respects, you know, Nancy Pelosi, for example, who considers herself, and in fact she is, a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, I mean, she deserves quite a bit of scorn,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And she's another that has gotten a little better, but for the most part is still, you know, silent.
I had a frank conversation about a week ago with my Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who
yeah.
is in the Progressive Caucus, out of Iraq Caucus.
Right.
She's been front and center on a lot of critical issues, and I think by her own count, she has spoken out from the House floor about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan more than 300 times.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible.
And I've become a little bit of a nag, Jason, and you've heard this spiel from me before, but
yeah.
When I meet a member of Congress or interview them, I make sure to say to them, I want my Fourth Amendment rights back.
Right. Yeah,
and,
good for you.
And Woolsey kind of looked at me quizzically and said, well, what do you mean? And I said, the FISA reform last summer, I said, flies directly, contradictorily, in the face of our Fourth Amendment rights to probable cause
right.
and a court warrant, a court order. Before we can be subject to surveillance. And I told her about my recent interview with Mark Klein,
yeah.
the guy who disclosed the tapping room, the splitter room in San Francisco at the AT&T facilities.
Right.
And Lynn admitted she didn't know a whole lot about that. And I said, well, you know, is anybody talking about these constitutional issues? And she said, you know, there's a real chilling effect on Democrats right now. If we sound off against the Obama administration, the leadership kind of sits on us and says, are you running against the president? Are you criticizing the president? And so this...
As if that was something that, you know, you should not be allowed to do.
It's politically incorrect.
Right.
Yeah. And I do understand the need for party discipline on crucial votes, and I want Blanche
right.
Lincoln and those soft Democrats to support the health care reform when it comes to cloture votes, even if they can't vote for the bill itself. So I'm not, you know, trying to say that there shouldn't be some sort of party discipline at times, but free and fair debate and criticism on very important issues. You know, it's not like they're criticizing the choice of the presidential dog or where he's going on vacation or anything like that. These are some of the most critical issues that our elected leaders are charged with dealing with.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, just to underscore that point, when you have documents released and just staying on the FISA issue, you know, the Inspector General's report, groundbreaking report that went even deeper in showing how the Bush administration circumvented the law and operated, you know, surveillance that went beyond the program that they publicly admitted to. I mean, you know, you cannot release this material and then, you know, simply just sweep it under the rug afterwards. I mean, there needs to be accountability. And if accountability just simply means an investigation or a hearing or something to that effect, I mean, how dare they say that you know you're going against the president or the administration? And let's face it, you know, Obama has been in office now for more than half a year. He has made it abundantly clear that he has no interest in revisiting, for opening up any sort of investigation or probe or looking into the Bush administration. He has made that clear. He does not want any of this to detract from his domestic agenda. And eventually, Peter, you know, as more time passes, he is going to be the one to own it. He can no longer hide behind, you know, my administration inherited this.
Mm-hmm.
He is going to own it, and the more time that passes without any investigation or accountability, he's complicit as far as I'm concerned, and frankly, as far as many people out there are concerned who have been, you know, calling for an investigation into a wide range of issues. So, you know, again, the FISA report, the other reports and memos that are coming out. I mean, it's frankly awful that you know he has been so reluctant to even you know acknowledge the need for you know for further understanding of this.
Yeah. And Jason, now let's talk about the status of Eric Holder, the Attorney General. He floated a trial balloon. It's now the balloon's turning yellow because
right.
it's been up there for a while. That, oh, maybe we should have some investigations about torture.
Right.
But that trial balloon was very narrowly framed. And it was, well, you know, we're not going to prosecute people who abided by the memos from John Yoo and Jay Bybee that authorized torture. Because after all, they had a document that said it was okay. Now, that was
right.
a defense that we didn't allow the Germans to use at Nuremberg, but it has surfaced here.
Yeah.
And what
yeah.
he's talking about is looking for some egregious cases. Now, we know that there are some people who died in American custody as they were being interrogated,
right.
and those have not been properly investigated, and they should. But that's not what we're asking for.
No,
the accountability we want is for the people who framed that policy.
Right.
And that starts with you and Bybee, but it also includes the vice president, the president, the principals group at the National Security Council, and it's a range of Bush administration officials that numbers, you know, somewhere between 25 and 50, depending on exactly how far down the food chain you want to go.
Right.
And it's clear that even in the trial balloons, that Eric Holder is not planning anything on that scale.
Yeah, I think that, you know, first of all, let me just say that this, absolutely, you're correct. It was a trial balloon because the number of media outlets that reported this, sort of all relying upon, you know, unnamed sources, were about a half dozen and within like a day of each other. And it's clear that the reason that this so-called, you know, investigation or possible investigation that may be conducted by some sort of special counsel within the Justice Department would be conducted is because there's going to be a critical report that will be issued, you know, perhaps within the next 2 weeks. And this is the CIA Inspector General's report, which is, you know, it's such a scathing report into the interrogation, into the torture program that if they were to release it, which they're facing a, you know, a federal court order to release it, it's part of a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, and if they were to just simply let that go, let that be released, as they did the Justice Department torture memos and other things, they would face quite a bit of a backlash, because this report does say that, you know, detainees not just died, Peter, they were murdered. And there were recommendations for to the Justice Department at the time this report was completed in 2004 for criminal investigations and perhaps even prosecution. So the report talks about the fact that there were, you know, these deaths, the fact that the interrogation methods, the torture methods, actually appear to violate the Convention Against Torture, Geneva Conventions. And so, you know, any decision he makes would come on the heels of that report, as these news stories indicated. However, you know, and that, I believe, is the Obama administration's way of appeasing, you know, or their belief that they would be appeasing, you know, people who have been calling for accountability. But in narrowing the investigation to the quote-unquote few bad apples, as the Bush administration described soldiers who were targeted for the abuses at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, it would simply just amount to a cover-up. And in fact, it would not be any different than the 12 investigations that were conducted following the Abu Ghraib scandal. You know, again, those investigations focused on the quote-unquote few bad apples, and the individuals who were given the authority to, you know, start a probe into the atrocities were forbidden prohibited from going up the food chain. And so Eric Holder, looking at, you know, some sort of rogue interrogators, rogue CIA or contract interrogators, would simply just be a way to, you know, cover this up. I mean, what would be the point in doing that? You know, because one interrogator happened to, you know, go above and beyond the amount of water that should be applied to some detainees, but at the same time, you know, these interrogators have already disclosed, we know from documents that were released, and I reported it, that there was a daily torture update that they provided from the field to the CIA in Langley, and it's highly likely that that also was communicated to the White House. As you said, Dick Cheney personally, he admitted this, he personally signed off on the waterboarding of what he claims was just, you know, three individuals, Abu Zubaydah, al-Nashiri, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And, you know, the fact is that these memos, these daily torture updates, clearly show that the torture was micromanaged from, you know, up high. So we don't know, you know, what they said. For Eric Holder or for anyone in this administration to say we're only going to focus on, you know, on these few individuals, it's basically saying we're going to whitewash this. Well, you know, it simply makes no sense. And I think that, you know, this administration has made some bad moves and bad choices in terms of, you know, their response to these apparent war crimes. And they're only going to make it worse if in fact, he does come out and says, you know, this investigation will be limited in scope. Because as, you know, as you indicated and as I reported, Dick Cheney, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, you know, Doug Feist, these are people who were making the decisions. You know, and also certainly you had the CIA contractors and the psychologists that were, you know, on the payroll who discussed how to administer these techniques and coming up with, you know, various methods. But the approvals came from up high. I mean, that's outrageous. That's you know, basically saying that, you know, you're going to just let Pinochet, you know, get away with everything while the folks who carried out his vision, because that's what it was, will be the ones prosecuted. I think it's a terrible precedent that this administration would continue, one that was set by the Bush administration. And by the way, you know, let me just add that Antonio Taguba, who investigated Abu Ghraib, he did want to go up that food chain. And he expressed that in a New Yorker article in June 2007, I believe. And in that article, it was one written by Seymour Hersh, he said that at every instance in which he tried to go beyond, you know, the few bad apples, he was blocked. And he believed that these soldiers did not just, you know, act upon themselves. He absolutely said that, you know, he believed that there was enough evidence to show that they were taking orders, but he was not allowed to go further.
Mm-hmm. And Jason, back 4 or 5 years ago, I remember talking to one of my military buddies.
Yeah.
And I said, Rumsfeld, is he a micromanager? And the expression that they used at the Pentagon was that Rumsfeld was the equivalent of a screwdriver that was about 6,000 miles long. And that he would tinker,
right.
You know, he would tinker with things by remote control.
Right.
Well, we know that they made videotapes of
exactly.
The interrogations and then destroyed them.
Right.
We know that, as you alluded to, that this Principals Committee of the National Security Council was often getting emails or other types of messages
right.
Several times over the course of a day asking for permission to use specific methods in an interrogation that was then underway.
Exactly.
And so this really is not a matter where they can cut out these lower-level people who were doing the dirty work and suggest that, oh, they went off the reservation,
right.
They couldn't read the memos, or, you know, whatever excuse they want to use.
It would be worse. It would, you know, they would almost be better off, Peter, not doing any investigation. than to do a, you know, half-assed investigation into, you know, these interrogators who, you know, they're saying the ones that went above and beyond. And what I mean by that, just to get specific, is that in the memos that were just released in April, the torture memos, one memo showed that the amount of water, okay, that was applied, that was used during the waterboarding of I'm not sure if it's Abu Zubaydah or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but the amount of water exceeded the levels that was legally permissible. They actually had an amount of water you could use, and so they exceeded that. In addition, they're saying that these, you know, interrogators or the waterboarding specifically, you can only, you know, waterboard for a certain amount of time, you know, during a certain number of days. But in 1 month, they you know, waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times.
And what the hell did they expect?
Right. Well, exactly.
I mean, come on, after, pick your number, but after a dozen times, after
right.
25, this is a guy who either before or after torture has admitted to things that he couldn't possibly have done.
Exactly.
And at Guantanamo, he's leading this gang of five or six people who all want to be martyred, and they're pleading guilty, and they want to cop to things, again, that they couldn't possibly have been responsible for, even if they were responsible for some of the things that our government charges them with.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the same goes for, you know, the Abu Zubaydah. I mean, he was, in 1 month, waterboarded in August 2002, the month that the actual first torture memo was written, or supposedly the first torture memo, 83 times. So what they're looking at, and this was something that the Inspector General's report zeroed in on, saying that, you know, hey, you guys are exceeding the rules here, or the, you know, the actual law that was put into place, saying that this can be done. But again, we don't know what Dick Cheney said, what George Tenet said, what Condoleezza Rice said, and clearly, just by the public, you know, statements, by the admissions by Cheney saying that he signed off on it, an investigation would have to, you know, any sort of investigation would have to, you know, look at Cheney and find out what he said and did. And frankly, for that matter, what if one of these interrogators that they, you know, that if this investigation were to happen, said that, you know what, yeah, I did this, but the vice president told me. Then what? You know, I mean, you know, Cheney gets a pass or George Tenet gets a pass or whomever, and, you know, we're just going to focus on that. That, you know, again, that's why I say that it's almost better to not conduct any investigation involved. If you're not going to conduct one that's thorough, then why bother?
So are we going to leave it to Spain? Is there any middle ground? Do you see a way that the U.S. could impanel some sort of an international commission? I know if we use the United Nations that John Bolton would self-immolate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That mustache would just go up in smoke.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm looking for some way, given the refusal of Obama to do this using our existing structure.
Right.
I feel like we need to look for some other way to investigate these crimes that, and it pains me to say this, but that bypasses the Democratic administration.
It does, and you know, and that's part of the problem as well, is that, you know, you still have people like Patrick Leahy, Senate Judiciary Chairman, and you know, and John Conyers, for that matter, and you know, they both have these proposals to have some sort of truth commission. But let's face it, Peter, I mean, come on. Are they actually, you know, aggressively pursuing that? Of course not. You know, they're reactionary. They're reacting to press releases and documents and news reports and continuously trying to say that, hey, you know, this is why we need to have a truth commission. But it doesn't appear like anything's going to happen. I will say this, however. Earlier this week, and this didn't really get any mention, and this kind of underscores the point of how much people have given up on their lawmakers. Gerald Nadler, from the congressman from New York.
Yeah, he's a pit bull without lipstick.
Yeah, that he is. He actually sent a letter, a very good letter, And I wrote about this, and just FYI, nobody else has. He sent a letter to Eric Holder this week. And that letter not only reiterated one that he and other members of the Judiciary Committee, of which he is a member, sent in April, that includes John Conyers, but he sent this letter this week, you know, reiterating his calls for a special counsel. He sent that letter to Holder. And in addition to that, he did zero in on the news reports that said it's my, you know, it's his understanding that if there is an investigation, it would be limited in scope. And in his letter, he said that's absolutely unacceptable. And here's why. And he discussed and cited, you know, the provision and or section of the Geneva Conventions of the war of the Convention Against Torture, War Crimes Act, etc. He went, all the way to try and drive home the point that any investigation would have to include the individuals who set the policy, and that includes John Yoo and Jay Bybee and others.
Let me lift a quote here from your article, and you're quoting Congressman Nadler.
Yes.
There simply is no legal, moral, or principled reason to insulate those who authorize the torture of detainees, either through legal reasoning or other policy directive, from investigation. This country has been instrumental in establishing the principle that high-ranking officials and lawyers who use legal reasoning to justify or otherwise authorize war crimes can and should be held legally accountable. The ban on torture is absolute, and we have a legal obligation to investigate torture and all of those who may have been party to its use.
Exactly. And you know what? Holder knows that. The White House knows that.
Yeah.
They all know that. And that's why this issue, Peter, and it is an issue. Torture should not be an issue. It should be we should be calling it for what it is, a war crime. But the Obama administration, and certainly the Bush administration, but they were the ones, you know, who were doing this, but the Obama administration has been treating this as politics. They've politicized it. They've allowed it to become politicized in the media. And because they did not simply put an end to it very early on by saying, yeah, we'll have a 9/11 commission type, investigation, whatever it is, anything to show, you know, that they were actually serious about it. Instead, it's become politicized. They've allowed it to. It continues to be politicized. And frankly, think about this. I mean, this was a letter. You know, certainly it was the second one. But for crying out loud, we have a member of Congress that is, you know, calling for an investigation into torture. And it's been met with silence. You know, good for him for actually doing it twice, but people have no faith. They don't really take it seriously, and that's very sad.
Well, and this is where, as I referenced earlier, this Leflon problem.
Right.
Gerald Nadler should just take this bull by the horns and start calling witnesses before his committee.
Exactly. He is the chairman of the subcommittee over there on civil rights, I believe, and you know, he can certainly do that. But we all know that there's, you know, procedures in place. But let's face it, you know what? Since 2006, since the Democrats won the midterm elections, they haven't done anything at all that has, you know, illustrated that they have, you know, that they are serious about, you know, whether it has to do with the Iraq War, with reining in the cost, ending the war, FISA. I mean, let's face it. They've actually approved everything. You know, they've signed off on everything, and they, you know, they're great at the rhetoric, but they're not willing to get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to do anything at all that would hurt the Democrat chances of holding on to, you know, their seat.
Yeah, Democratic accountability since they took control after the 06 elections has amounted to a series of news releases, photo ops, and one-day news stories.
Right.
They do not hang in there and follow things to a natural conclusion.
Yeah, and you know what? The only person that I can recall truly who has actually, you know, put his career on the line has been Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah.
You know, and look, what is Dennis, who, you know, Dennis Kucinich is to some degree treated as as beyond far left, as a loon in some sense, because he has the audacity to stand up for what's right and
yeah.
what's just. And you know, actually, I think that's that speaks volumes. And Democrats, frankly, they don't want to do anything.
Now, Jason, you're familiar with the Men in Black movie and that gizmo that Will and Tommy Lee had called the Neuralizer. And they wore sunglasses so that when they flashed this thing to cause amnesia in the people around them, it didn't affect them.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if there was a mass neuralization and I missed it. Because, you know, the first 2 months of this administration, or at least in January and part of February, we saw promising signs. The flourish of announcing he wanted to close Guantanamo, Eric Holder's blunt testimony that waterboarding is torture. And so the early signs indicated that, well, we're going to see some progress. We're going to see some accountability here. And then, you know, with the appointment of Leon Panetta, which I initially found encouraging, and his confirmation hearings where Kit Bond slapped him back because he asserted there had been torture, and Bond just basically said, prove it.
Right.
And Panetta apologized and backpedaled, and it really made me feel sad for that man because I had respect for him. And so I'm trying to figure out in this short span of time how we went from these promising moments to what appears to be just a dead stone wall.
Yeah, well, you know, I would encourage people, particularly on the Panetta issue and just in general, the bureaucracy that certainly exists at the CIA and how somebody like Panetta, who last year had authored a number of columns, you know, highly critical of the Bush administration's use of torture and, violating the law, which he pretty much said. Mel Goodman, who is a former CIA analyst, spent, almost a quarter of a century at the CIA. He's penned a number of great columns that really explains how, you know, you get lost in the bureaucracy there and how Panetta, how that happened to him very quickly. He was he became part of the bureaucracy very quickly and certainly has shown that. And if people are interested, they should really, you know, check it out on our website. But
let's pause for a second. Pubrecord.org.
Yes.
And the website has been vastly upgraded. It's really powerful. A lot of tabs there where you can find things in a quick click or a search. And I'm just really pleased to recommend it to people. And Jason, in that same tone...
let me just add, that goes for Obama as well. I mean, so, you know, John Dean actually made a great point of this in one of his Bindlaw columns, just in his, you know, in his experience, what he sees is that in the first 100 days, what happens to a president who makes these, you know, these statements and these broad, you know, these promises, they get lost in the bureaucracy. And part of that is that bureaucracy has always existed. It's there. Certainly, he's got, you know, holdovers from the Bush administration who have dragged him into it. And as far as Panetta goes, you know, you look at the people that are around him. I mean, he's got Stephen Capps. I believe that's how you pronounce his.
I think it's Kappas.
Kappas. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, he is somebody who is instrumental in the policies of torture that were used.
Brennan, the other guy, at the White House.
Yeah, and guess what? Brennan was also involved in FISA. So, you know, you've got these people who are basically telling Obama, telling Panetta, like, if you do this, it will kill our troops. It will, close down intelligence channels. But you have the career folks like Mel Goodman, folks that have actually, you know, spent real time out there saying that's absolutely untrue.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, it happened very quickly here. You know, I think that it's pretty clear that, you know, Obama may have wanted to live up to these promises, but he acted very quickly in upholding, you know, many of the arguments that the Bush administration put forth.
And Jason, you and I talked a couple of days ago. I had a recent conversation that will be featured in a future podcast with Richard Barlow.
Yeah.
And he was bounced out of the CIA in 1989. And in his case, he testified truthfully before Congress under explicit instructions to do so from his superiors at the agency and then got absolutely screwed for it. But I opened the conversation with him with a point-blank question relating to the conflict between Panetta and Pelosi just a couple of months ago about whether the CIA has lied to Congress. And I said, Richard, in your experience, has the CIA ever lied to Congress?
Yeah.
And, of course, he laughed at first, and he said, absolutely.
Yeah.
He said, it's been going on for years, and here's the kicker. He said, and there are members of Congress who like it that way.
Right.
They don't want to know the truth.
Right. And by the way, that's absolutely true. And, you know, you start getting into real conversations with experienced people like this and not listening to the Pete Hoekstras and, you know, the ones that are trying to grab the headlines. That is the truth, you know, and that is the sad reality, the elephant in the room, if you will, is that they know that this is going on and they don't want to know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And it's truly remarkable. I mean, you know, look at Panetta. He wrote this column last week in the Washington Post. It was, you know, it was you remember that video, Leave Britney Alone?
Yeah.
That's exactly how this column came off. Leave the CIA alone. You know, if Panetta were to make a video, I would imagine that he would, you know, be crying in there.
Come on, there's spying going on over here. You're going to distract us.
It's truly unbelievable that he said that, you know, he more or less said that 9/11, you know, created this sort of situation, this fear that resulted in people breaking the law, you know, in government in order to, quote-unquote, protect the security of the United States. And in that sense, you know, they deserve a pass. And that's exactly what he said. And this is, you know, I've got to say, Peter, this may sound sort of depressing. When it comes down to it, certainly, you know, we want health care reform, and there are Democrats that are doing a good job in that. But as a whole, people should really not, you know, I would imagine that a lot of people don't have faith in even Democrats right now. And as far as I'm concerned, they're doing a terrible job. You know, they are not living up to the promises that, first of all, that they made, and they're not listening to their, you know, to the people who voted them into office.
Yep.
Absolutely not listening to them. They still, are interests with the lobbyists, still playing games with that. But when it comes to this, when it comes to, you know, these issues of accountability, which they promised, they're absolutely, you know, not living up to it.
Yeah.
And I think that you're going to wind up seeing this, you know, this continue. And
so, Jason, to wrap up on Holder, do you think it's worthwhile to continue to lobby him and try to put pressure on him? Will we break through?
That, you know, again, that's why I said that it was so sad that, you know, I put the story out. I said, hey, folks, you know, look, somebody's wrote a letter to Eric Holder and calling him out to make sure that he holds people accountable. But it, you know, as long as it goes silent, certainly they're not going to take any action. I think that the pressure that continues to build does actually have an impact. And certainly, you know, let's face it, the ACLU has been remarkable in really, you know, not only prying loose these secret documents, but in applying pressure. And I think that, you know, if people were to respond in that sort of fashion with, you know, the way that this, you know, obviously this organization has is very well coordinated, but if people were to simply act, you know, by contacting Holder, writing a letter to him. In fact, you know what, this actually brings up a good point. On our website, and this is via the ACLU, there's a video there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Tortured Logic.
Yeah, I see it.
And it was, you know, it features, you know, prominent figures, Oliver Stone, Rosie Perez, actually calling on Holder to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a link from that video that goes to the ACLU's page where you can fill out online and request or send your note to him saying, you know, I want accountability. And it's that type of, grassroots activity that, people should absolutely continue to act on. Because at least they're doing something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, at least they're actually, if Holder ultimately decides not to do anything, at least, you know, you tried.
And also at pubrecord.org, I just want to recommend the work of Andy Worthington. I connected with Andy via Jason Leopold. And he is a great London-based reporter who has really gone into our Guantanamo detention center in great detail, listed every individual known to have been held there, and has great detail, too, on many of the cases that remain in play. And I'm really glad that you're publishing his work.
Oh, yeah. He's, you know, his work is groundbreaking. And, by the way, you know, it's got a very it's got a place in history that will last for a long time. I mean, you know, his book is The Guantanamo Files, and it's the definitive account. So, you know, I just want to emphasize that, you know, despite what I said, you know, in just ignoring it or just saying, whatever, my vote's not going to count or this, you know, you still have to do something.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think ultimately, you know, the pressure should remain.
Well, in a few minutes, we'll talk to David Ippolito, who's taking his own action on this, and I certainly applaud that. Jason, earlier this week, I clicked on pubrecord.org, and you broke the news to me that Greg Craig, the White House counsel in the Obama administration, may be eased out.
Yeah.
And it includes a commentary from Dana Jill Simpson, and I found that very interesting. She was the Republican who blew the whistle on Karl Rove's involvement in the Don Siegelman railroaded prosecution.
Right.
And she offered some very interesting background on Greg Craig. Now, many people know he was an advisor to President Clinton. He broke with the Clintons to support Barack Obama
right.
at a crucial time in the primaries last year and was rewarded with this plum job as White House counsel
yeah.
despite his legal career. And at the firm Williams & Connolly, which is a juice firm in Washington,
right.
He's represented a lot of people, CIA folks
right.
and Republicans, and Karl Rove is a prominent client of that firm.
Right. That's, you know, and it's pretty remarkable that he is he's got such close ties to Karl Rove. And certainly the way, Dana Jill Simpson describes it, I mean, he not only has close ties to Karl Rove via the firm, she alleges that they go back to the 70s. That, you know, they first met when Rove was doing, you know, some work for the Young Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that continued 30 years later. And then in addition to that, you know, the firm that Greg Craig worked at also represented Cheney and Bush and Bush's father and, you know, a host of others. And, you know, so she's basically saying that, you know, the door should be slammed on him. And, you know, largely because of these ties to Rove, to the Bush administration. And in addition to that, she actually goes into even greater detail. She claims that Craig had given her a phone call or that she spoke to him a couple of years ago and that he expressed perhaps some interest in representing her after she blew the whistle on the Siegelman prosecution,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, she accused him and her attorney as well, accused Craig of ethical violations and called on him to step down from any matters related to the Bush administration because of the negotiation that he was doing to get Rove to testify before the Judiciary Committee with regard to his alleged involvement in the Siegelman prosecution and the firing of nine prosecutors. But, you know, what's interesting here is that, you know, it's being alleged that Craig advocated for transparency, that's my word, advocated for releasing the Justice Department memos, advocated for even, you know, apparently releasing the latest batch of torture photographs that Obama flip-flopped on, and as well as his work in, you know, working to close down or coming up with a plan to close down Guantanamo and perhaps move some detainees here to the U.S. for prosecution. And it's the backlash, apparently, that resulted, the backlash in terms of, you know, how it affected Obama, how it affected him, you know, be it by, you know, the polls or, you know, the fact that Democrats resisted on any of these plans, that has actually caused, you know, some problems with, you know, with some members of the administration. They felt that, you know, perhaps he's not the guy to be around because of, because of his position, which I have to tell you, Peter, is really kind of difficult to believe. You know, I have to say that there seems to be something a little bit bigger here, and I'm not quite sure I believe that. You know, certainly somebody's out to stick a knife in his back, and you know, if the claims are, well, you know, he advocated for all this stuff, and that's why we're getting rid of him. That would just seem strange.
Mm-hmm.
But I should say that. And there is a little bit related here. Back when Newsweek, I think it was about a month ago, they're the ones that first floated this trial balloon on Eric Holder. Eric Holder perhaps, appointing a prosecutor to investigate this.
Yeah.
In that story,
Isikoff reported it. Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay. Well, in that story, there was some discussion about the fact that Craig had been butting heads with some people in the Justice Department, and that there was a specific incident that the Justice Department went to court about in which they invoked state secrets that Obama got very upset about because he didn't know about it until he read about it in the newspaper.
Hmm.
And basically, these unnamed Justice Department officials said, we advised, the White House counsel's office, and if you're upset, be upset with him. So, my point is that there's clearly a lot going on internally. But I think that aside from that, what is true and what's not true, the fact remains that Greg Craig was probably not the best choice to begin with. And I certainly think that that holds true for his representations or misrepresentations about his relationship with Karl Rove, and it does call into question if he's actually doing work on to protect his friends or the White House. And let's face it, in this day and age, and what we've seen over the years, I don't think that's something that's so far out there to raise a fuss about.
So I mentioned this neuralizer idea, and do you think that somewhere in the spring, and I'm pegging it in late February to early April, somewhere in there, that the control of Rahm Emanuel as White House Chief of Staff solidified to the point where he is really the one calling these shots and saying that we are focused only on health care reform.
Right.
We want no distractions, and, that we're going to lock this stuff down. Now, that presents the possibility that if we ever get out of the health care drama, and I'm not very excited about what's developing at this point,
right,
that there will be bandwidth to pay attention to other issues. But I don't buy that, because we're always going to have economic problems. We,
of course.
We're going to be fighting this for some time to come. The wars are not about to just end on their own. And so, my belief is that this is just buying time and hoping that people will be distracted by another pop star's death or, new controversy with Paula Abdul leaving American Idol.
Look, I think that, it's absolutely true, and they're going to come up with, another excuse. If in fact, as you said, the healthcare reform gets passed and the economy even recovers, whatever it is, they'll come up with another excuse. But I think that if anyone who knows Rahm Emanuel and certainly knows not only how he worked in the in the Clinton administration, certainly how he worked in Congress, I think he's absolutely calling the shots. And in fact, the statement that was issued in response to Craig's rumored leaving his post is came from the deputy chief of staff. That's kind of unusual. You'd really have to perhaps maybe start reading tea leaves there. But the deputy chief of staff to issue a statement, even though that statement said these are just rumors, it's outrageous. That's stuff that you usually get from the press office. That's not something where the chief of staff actually steps up and says anything. So. It's almost as if they floated the rumor, or if they leaked it and then at the same time commented on the record about it. So obviously it's a bit inside baseball for some people, but I think that you know, Rahm Emanuel is the one who told Joe Lieberman and Lindsey Graham personally that these photographs would, quote, never see the light of day, and I'm talking about the abuse photographs, the torture photographs, and that is actually going over the recommendations, apparently, of Craig. So I think that the the strife that's happening internally is probably between, you know, Rahm Emanuel and Greg Craig and, you know, some of the decisions and recommendations that are reflecting poorly on Obama.
Well, we're going to have to see who shows up for work after Labor Day. Possibly some people will quietly leave the White House during the summer break here.
Yeah, but just keep in mind, Peter, that, you know, in about 2 weeks from today, that report, I believe, is supposed to be out by the CIA Inspector General's office. So, obviously, if anything happens with regard to Holder, I think that you'll probably hear about it, you know, perhaps a day earlier.
Okay. Well, Jason, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you for bringing us up to speed on these issues. And thanks for all your great reporting at the Public Record. The website, again, pubrecord.org. Jason Leopold, thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
And the Peter B. Collins Show continues. In a moment, we'll meet David Ippolito, that guitar man from New York.
Words came down the night, just a few words at a time. Meaning it was clear, there was no sound of fear. The scenes that they describe were sad, you couldn't cry. Journey's just too long to even take a ride. It's always the same, it's always in vain. The truth will only know, the words had only shown. But lies and deception, they move in one direction, and then in the end, you lose.
One of my favorite former punk bands, they're called The Stranglers. They went kind of techno-pop in the 80s, and that one's called Lies and Deception. As we continue talking about the posture of the Obama administration toward the criminal acts that occurred while George W. Bush was president. And joining me now is that guitar man from Central Park, David Ippolito. David, thanks for joining me on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Now, you and I are just talking really for the first time here, and I contacted you because I was really struck by a TV commercial I saw on MSNBC the other night, and you're in it. Tell me where this commercial came from and what you're trying to get people to do.
Actually, you know, it was kind of an amazing evolution. As a songwriter, I say this all the time, you don't very often get to write the next song you want to write. You write the next song that wants to be written. And when I saw President Obama just soon after he was inaugurated in an interview with his legs crossed, and he said, let me be perfectly clear, no one is above the law, but I think it's important that we look forward as opposed to looking backwards. And I thought to myself then, there was a song in the room with me suddenly, right then. I thought, you cannot say the words, no one is above the law, because then everything after but is bull. So the song, basically, I looked around and I thought, there are a lot of guys writing songs of social conscience, but they're all, you know, Bruce is doing it,
yeah,
and Neil Young is doing it.
Yeah.
But I thought they're all of a certain generation. I wanted to write a song, if I could, that would cross generation. So I got a young rap artist named J.C. Hall, and I got a young African-American woman, a fantastic soul singer named Teresa Reynolds, and I set out to write a song that would cross generation and genre and race and style. And I didn't know we were going to pull it off until about halfway through the process. I turned to the engineer and I said, man, it's nice to be right. And so the song was written. I did a video in iMovie 06, put it up on YouTube. In mm-hmm. fact, I urge every single person who's listening to this right now to go to YouTube and check out Resolution, the torture song. And it, what happened was a woman out on the West Coast saw this on the internet and was so moved by it and so impassioned by it that she contacted a friend of mine and said, this really should be made into a commercial that we can get on the air so we can put it in every home in America. So the challenge was, how do we get a six-minute song into a 30-second commercial? And we thought, you know what, let's just point people at the song so that we can urge them to contact Eric Holder just very simply to do his job.
Right. And who is this West Coast woman?
Well, what happened is, I haven't met her yet. I've met her over the phone. She is, to me, Peter, I got to tell you, you know, I would say 15 minutes before Rosa Parks had a confrontation, she didn't know she was going to be Rosa Parks, you know?
Yeah.
This woman is a retired librarian, lives in Berkeley. I've never met her. I live in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Cynthia Papermaster. She's involved in all these things. She feels passionately about our Constitution and about justice and about the crimes that were committed under the George Bush administration. She is so passionate about it. She promised me, she said, if you make a commercial, I'll find the money to put it on the air.
Wow.
So I said, okay, well, then we'll do it. We did it on a leap of faith. We got an Emmy Award-winning director to shoot it. Everybody worked for about 72 hours, and we shot these commercials on faith. And then I learned that she was actually draining money from her 401k and putting $50,000 on her American Express card to
wow.
make this happen.
Wow.
I'm so passionate about this. Right now, I've learned, now being involved in this in the last like 10 days, this is happening so fast. But I've been involved now with all of these, you know, activist organizations and all these .orgs and all of these bloggers, and I've learned something. You know what bloggers do? They blog. what we need,
yeah.
You know, it's funny. Everybody talks about web hits, and everybody talks about YouTube views and how impressive it is to get 7,000 views in a week. But you know what we need? We need every single person who's listening to your show right now to hit the donate button and just give $10. We need 10,000 people to give $10, and we will put this message in every home in America.
All right, let's listen a little bit to this tune. This is very powerful stuff. It's called Resolution, the Torture Song. David Ippolito with us.
Starts to boil every time the old coward speaks. Through cold gray eyes, he euphemizes his damned enhanced techniques, but he's talking about torture.
Picture of Cheney.
And anybody with a soul knows that. Frighten the people, then you dumb them down and got them running like a herd of sheep. I can name the year their crippling fear put half their souls to sleep, but we're talking about torture. And anybody with a soul knows that. Pitiful, pedantic Potsy got his very own TV show. He's a callow man's shallow man, but deep in his heart he's got to know that it's torture. It's hiding right behind his next wise crack.
Glenn Beck and Limbaugh.
This silly fool is so far through that looking glass. I got a feeling he can't come back.
And don't forget O'Reilly, he was in there too.
Can pay it off, Mr. Hope.
Picture of Obama.
What if yesterday is tossed?
Your life, no alibis. You look me in the eyes and say that I'm wasting my border between waterboarding and torture. And these scumbags knew that when they put in the order. A Texas sheriff got 10 years for using it in 83. Went to the Supreme Court. What's the memory? Hazy. Bush's legal advisors may not have mentioned that case, but it happened not long before he was governor of that state. How could he possibly forget something that hit so close? Must be an idiot or negligent. Probably both. In the past, we punished U.S. soldiers who waterboard too. And look what happened to the Japanese after World War II. We hung several of them at the Tokyo Tribunal. The DOJ couldn't find precedents. Try Google.
So hide that breach with a speech until we reach that final spot.
We'll post the link to this video in our show notes at peterbcollins.com. And there is more. We're about halfway through this, but I recommend that you see the YouTube connection there, see the video for yourself. And right there embedded into the video is Eric Holder's phone number and also an email address at the Department of Justice. And I encourage you to use them and send a message in your own words about why you want accountability. And David Ippolito, if you were to tick off the two or three reasons why this is so important to you, what would they be?
Well, you know, I'm a guy that's a registered independent. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. You can call me a liberal, and I'll just say thank you. But I love the idea of this country. I love the principles upon which it was founded. And so I think it's that important for me to do whatever we can. Maybe, I'm telling you, I'm thinking as an artist, it's entirely possible the bad guys have won, but I don't want to think that. I think it's time for us to take it to the streets, to put it in every home in America, and just say, no, you can't do that, not in my name.
Well, you're speaking for me, David, and I just want to thank you as one American to another for taking up this matter and using your skills, your artistic talents, your connections, and networking with other people, including this stranger, Cynthia Papermaster in Berkeley. I've got to look her up so I can thank her.
Absolutely. And, you know, Peter, this is the thing, though. You know, I'm not a hero. Cynthia is the hero as far as I'm concerned. The main thing is, though, we can't do this alone. I really, truly mean this. We need every single person who's listening to this right now to go to thatguitarman.com and just whatever they can give. If they can get $1,000, great. But if they can drop a $10 thing in that donation button, mm-hmm. then that'll make this happen. But we've got to show up.
All right. Well, David, thanks again. And I'm delighted to meet you. And I hope people will go to your website and find out more about you. You seem to be a prolific artist. You got a lot of CDs up there. And you perform every Saturday in Central Park?
Yeah, I'm the luckiest man alive, Peter. But thank you so much for even asking me to speak about this.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, David Ippolito.
All right, man.
Next on the Peter B. Collins Show, we talk nanotechnology.
There is just one moon and one golden sun, and the smile means friendship to everyone. Though the mountains divide and the oceans are wide, it's a small world after all.
Oh, it's really, 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 really a small world. Nanotechnology explores the building blocks that make up atoms. And those in turn are the building blocks for particles. And you can tell that I'm fumbling with my high school physics. Let's turn to somebody who knows more than I do. Jim Motovalli is a senior writer for E! The Environmental Magazine. And their current issue has some interesting pro and con questions about nanotechnology. Jim is also one of the country's leading authorities on electric vehicles, clean energy, and other environmental issues. He's written numerous books. He writes for the New York Times automobile section. And he's a radio guy. He's got a biweekly public affairs show on a public radio station in Connecticut. Jim, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Great to be on.
Good to talk with you. And I want to open by lifting a couple of paragraphs from your colleague, Carol Bass, in this issue of E! The Environmental Magazine, July-August of 2009. It reads this way. It's a beautiful summer day. You pull on your stain-resistant cargo shorts and odor-resistant hiking socks. You gulp down an energy-boosting supplement, slather yourself with sunscreen, and head out for a ramble in the woods. Are you poisoning yourself? When you get home, you jump in the shower, you toss your clothes in the wash. Are you poisoning the environment? Maybe. Your sunscreen, the energy drink, and high-tech clothing may be among the 800-plus consumer products made with nanomaterials, those manufactured at the scale of atoms and molecules. Sunscreen that turns clear on the skin contains titanium dioxide, an ordinary UV blocker, in extraordinarily small particles. Odor-eating socks are made with atoms of germ-killing silver. Supplement makers boast of amazing health effects from swallowing nano-solutions that are completely untested for effectiveness or safety. And that stain-repellent clothing? The manufacturer won't even tell you what nanomaterials are in it. Are we heading into a faith-based era here, Jim, where we just have to take it on faith that these products are safe?
I haven't heard it put that way, but I think that's a very good summation. Yes, we are basically taking it on faith that these substances that we're introducing into commerce, and we're actually slathering it on our bodies in some cases in terms of cosmetics and sunscreens, I think that we are definitely assuming that this stuff is harmless, and we really don't have the evidence to back that up.
And is Underwriters Laboratories looking at any of this stuff? Are there independent clinics that test this, not on rats, because we can't do that anymore?
Only a very small amount of the research that's going into nanotechnology is actually looking at human health effects. I think in the last year that this evidence was, or this information was accumulated, it was something like $100 million out of a much, much larger budget. So there are some health studies, and some of them have had fairly alarming results. We've seen when, for instance, things like carbon nanotubes are injected into rats, they have some of the same effects as asbestos. We should probably define our terms here and just say that nanomaterials are extremely small. This is not stuff that you can see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like a flea is a million nanometers. And the stuff we're talking about is less than 100 nanometers.
Well, I have my scanning tunneling microscope right here. And that's what it takes, right, to actually view these things?
Yes. Yeah. They're on the atomic level.
Right.
Essentially.
Yeah. And in one of the stories that you contributed to this interesting issue of E! The Environment magazine, you profile or refer to Eric Drexler. And I've actually met him, and I interviewed him after he published his book, Engines of Creation, which is almost 20-plus years now. And he was a real visionary about the nano world, and I remember him describing this idea of injectable nanomachines that could be injected into my body and be routed, say, to my spleen, if I've got a problem in my spleen. And these nanomachines could help remove the bad organisms or kind of in the mentality that we now invoke for stem cell research, help rebuild damaged cells or the organisms that they make up.
Right, and I want to say up front that I'm not against all nano research. I'm not a Luddite who's saying that we shouldn't be doing any work on the nanoscale.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are some very real promises, and one of the best things we're seeing is the medical research that you're referring to. I believe that nano research has very good prospects for dealing with malaria and for other prominent diseases also. And if that's possible, then I think we should try to understand nanomaterials better.
Well, here in California, we thumbed our nose at Bush's ban on stem cell research, and we have been plunging ahead. There's a total of $3 billion that taxpayers approved over a 10-year period to invest, and we're seeing some of those projects underway right now, and it's very exciting. And when I agree with you that I have a very balanced approach to this. I think that there are great potentials, but we also have to monitor the downside and not just be so carried away that we don't look at the risk to humans, at the risk to our ecology, and that we don't create monsters as we're trying to solve human problems and deal with chronic illness and chronic medical conditions. But the promise we see in the integration of nanotechnology processes with the DNA mapping that has occurred and the potential for stem cells to tell us what causes disease and also to show us the way to repair the human body. And it leads to the potential for personalized medicine, where, Jim, you and I might have a similar condition, but be treated with different pharmaceuticals that are keyed to our specific DNA. All these have great potential, but we also need to look at monsters that we could create, the unintended consequences.
Well, maybe I could talk about the particular one that has to do with sunscreen.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that companies use nanomaterials, which are very small particles of very common substances in many cases, is that they have different physical properties at these very small sizes. And in this case, the active ingredients in sunscreen on the nano level are clear instead of white, and that means that instead of having a white nose, you have a more acceptable consumer product.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, a lot of sunscreens now contain nano versions of the active ingredients in sunscreen. And they are under no obligation to tell you that that's the case. They don't actually list, they're not required to list nano ingredients on the label. They are in Europe. In fact, that law was, I think, just passed a couple weeks ago. And I think Canada is moving in that direction. In the U.S., I don't even know of any pending legislation that would make require that you list nano ingredients. The only way we know that, say, 800 products have nano ingredients in them is those companies list them on the label, mm-hmm. or they have disclosed it. And basically, they're proud of it. It's a marketing thing. You know, if you have something like socks with nano heating or nano odor-eating properties, you proclaim that on the label.
Mm-hmm.
People think it sounds real scientifically advanced and high-tech, and so it's a marketing gimmick, basically. So they do it if they see an advantage in it, and something like 800 companies do that, and there's a lot of very common cosmetic companies are using nano ingredients. That also concerns me, because again, it's a topical application on your skin, and there's heated disagreements about whether healthy skin would present a barrier to nanomaterials. I've seen credible organizations come down on both sides of that. And Consumer Reports, for instance, cites all the different studies on it and say maybe you should avoid certain sunscreens with nano ingredients. And actually Consumer Reports, where I first saw this as an issue, and I was just alarmed that nano ingredients had gotten into commerce as much as it had,
mm-hmm.
to the extent of being in sunscreen. It's in many other very common household products like tennis rackets and golf clubs and pants. Someone told me they had a pair of nano-engineered swimming trunks that had like sunscreen engineered into them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that would possibly work. But food supplements, cake icings, all kinds of things. You know, definitely in food products, and that's one of the largest growing parts of the industry from what I hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you have a box here that shows some of the uses of nanoproducts right now. They're in dual-core processors made by AMD. The Sharper Image sells, are they still in business? Anyway, they sell antibacterial silver athletic and lounging socks, contour foam, silver crescent travel, and nap pillow. They're beer bottles made with nanoproducts, pet beds and clothing. So it is, and there's an acne treatment called Clearly It that has a nanoparticle containing moisturizers and antioxidants that nourish and repair the skin. But
well, just stop right there at that one.
Yeah.
The people who say that it's probably healthy skin is a good barrier to nano ingredients, okay?
Right, so my zits.
Your zits are a very good pathway.
Yeah.
Because that's an opening in the skin, right?
Sure
but
is.
Do you really want to apply something nano to that? I find that very, very odd as a product.
Yeah. And, Jim, you have a sidebar story here, regulating nanotech barely at the starting gate. And you note that in 2009, the federal government has earmarked a billion and a half for nano research. with only $256 million going to risk assessment. And then you quote Clayton Teague, director of the National Nanotechnology Coordination Office. Until we have information that there are truly inadequacies in existing regulations, any additional regulations beyond what we already have would be burdensome to industry and the advancement of the field. And then you, without getting too cheeky, you say it's not clear what existing relations regulations he's talking about. So I scribbled down here, so we're waiting for the first pattern of nano deaths before we wake up and really evaluate this stuff?
Well, you know, it would be notoriously difficult to basically pinpoint that someone had died of nano causes. If you, for instance, if you were, say, to contract cancer as a result of nano exposure, you would not be able to say that what caused it. There are so many causes of cancer, and you couldn't possibly trace it back. Therefore, it would only be speculation. And I think it would be difficult, under the best of circumstances, to have a absolute, smoking gun
mm-hmm.
with regards to nano ingredients.
Well, and without being alarmist, Jim, I just have to tell you that I live with a legacy on a daily basis. In my neighborhood is a group living home for people who are described as thalidomide babies. And they're my age. They were born in the 1950s.
I think that was more in Germany than in the U.S.
Well, we had a wave of it here. And there are about 150 people who live at this one facility in my neighborhood. And they're functional, but, you know, they're clearly damaged human beings. And this was, caused by our inattentiveness. We were racing to make life better, to live better through chemistry and biology. And certainly, you know, many people have benefited from those things, but we have to look at the ugly downside, too.
Yes, I think so. And I would hope that the Obama administration mandates a sort of go slow policy on nano. If you look at the actual products that they're in, whether sunscreen is clear or not is not a life or death thing. Sure, it's a nice marketing gimmick. Whether your socks have odor eating properties, which in most cases would probably wash out almost immediately anyway,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that matters that much. So, since we're not talking about something like stem cell research, I think we could afford to be a fairly cautious, like the Europeans have been, in introducing, particularly to uses that could be that could contact the skin
mm-hmm.
and cosmetics and sunscreens. I think that's particularly dangerous. And food, of course.
Yeah. Now, Jim, are you aware of any university research that takes the these issues into account, the negative impacts?
There's a lot of the research I've seen has been done by environmental groups. And one particular study I found interesting is the Environmental Working Group study. The Friends of the Earth came out and said basically that they put out a very alarming study. And then Environmental Working Group looked at the sunscreen issue, and they do very reliable research, I've found. And they came away saying that, in balance, they think that the exposure to the sun without sunscreen is actually more threatening than the nano exposure. They actually thought they would come to a different conclusion, but that was their conclusion in that particular
mm-hmm.
instance. They didn't think it would cross skin barrier and healthy skin.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when you have unhealthy skin, all the bets are off. I mean, if you have some kind of cut or lesion or shaving
sure.
cut or
mm-hmm.
Acne or any of those things, I think that would pose a problem.
Now, you have some recent quotes here from Dr. Eric Drexler, and some of it relates to the gray goo. Explain that concept and what his current level of concern is about it.
This is a gray goo is basically the logical outcome of self-replicating machines. And I believe Dr. Drexler was the first to say that if you create these sort of nanoscale machines that create other machines, you basically could have sort of a Terminator effect where they get out of control. You can't stop the process. And they gradually take over the world and turn everything into gray goo. He advanced this theory some time ago. I think he has since backed off it somewhat. He doesn't think it's going to happen, really. Mm-hmm. He was just postulating a theoretical possibility, mm-hmm. you could say. And the writer Bill McKibben picked up on that and did a chapter of one of his books about it, which I think mm-hmm. got a lot of the phrase gray goo
yeah.
to public discourse.
Yeah, he's a colorful guy. I like Bill.
Yeah.
Now, you also make passing reference to concerns about nanoweapons. I imagine if the Pentagon's working on it, we don't know about it. But what do we know about any efforts to develop weaponry in this science category?
Well, like you say, a lot of that is classified work, but I think you could think about the military implications of a self-replicating machine, what it could do or how it could be used aggressively. You know, in some ways it would be like a... like biological weaponry could be very, I think there's good reasons we have mm-hmm. Treaties banning things like that.
Well, and the most obvious, you know, current example of that is depleted uranium, which I do consider to be a biological weapon, and we have used it with abandon.
Right, we have. And I think in some cases that has backfired on our own troops
mm-hmm.
who have come back from the Gulf War in the 80s and... other conflicts with exposure to that depleted uranium and a lot of health effects.
Yeah. Well, Jim, I want to thank you for joining us and tell us a little bit about E, the environmental magazine. I just got a copy of this one that I have with your cover story about nano is the first I've seen.
Well, E has been around since 1990. It was launched then, and that was the 20th anniversary of Earth Day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bi-monthly magazine, and I think it's designed to be popular reading for people. It's nothing that's going to go over your head. It's not heavily science. It's not Scientific American or something like that.
Yeah, this story about the resurgence of boxed wine for ecological reasons is,
yeah.
you know, it's interesting, and it certainly caught my attention. I don't buy boxed wine, but maybe I'll try it.
And also, the other thing that's happening with wine is that people are moving away from corks.
Right.
And the screw top, which used to be anathema in wine,
yeah.
coming back. Let me mention also that, as you mentioned earlier in the show, I do write about the auto industry for the New York Times and
mm-hmm.
CBS Interactive and Hearst. And it's a very exciting time. I cover it as an environmental issue, and it's a very exciting time to be covering that right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. And is there a website for E, the environmental magazine?
Well, E Magazine is at just the way it sounds, emagazine.com, all one word.
Great. Well, Jim, pleasure to meet you. We'll talk again. Jim Motovalli, senior writer for E, the environmental magazine, here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails.